This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most of us have 2 3-day weekends coming up. You might spend some of that time at the movies, so we asked our film critic John Powers to join us and tell us about the new ones opening for the holidays.
Well, I think, you know, the most awaited film in some sense is Thin Red Line, which is a World War II film about Guadalcanal made by Terrence Malick, who's sort of a Hollywood legend. He made 2 films 20 years ago, Badlands and Days of Heaven, and then basically dropped out. And, you know, as often happens when you leave something, your legend only increases. So this is his first film in 20 years, and everybody's been really curious to see it for all sorts of reasons, not least because it seems to be some sort of bookend to Saving Private Ryan.
Is it good?
I don't know, in all honesty. It's extremely strange. It's based on a James Jones novel about a company fighting at Guadalcanal. And the novel by Jones is very, very down-to-earth and prosaic and dirty and grubby. It's perhaps the most realistic account of fighting and the psychology of fighting that, you know, that I've ever read. What Malick has done with this story is to turn it into sort of a metaphysical drama. So it's a kind of Zen war movie, if that makes any sense. You know, whereas Steven Spielberg in Saving Private Ryan basically sort of mythologized the Normandy landing and the people who landed at Normandy, what Malick does is he uses this war film as a sort of way of making a meditation on the nature of life, darkness versus light and all the rest. And, you know, so it's a very strange, kind of undramatic film filled with very powerful negative battle sequences and lots of complicated psychology and lots of interior monologues by lots of different characters, all of whom are sort of reflecting on the meaning of life. I mean, It's one of those films that I'll actually want to see again before I actually know whether it's good. At the moment, I was simultaneously impressed and kind of put off because it's not very emotionally engaging. And yet it's, you know, in some ways, extraordinary piece of filmmaking.
How is the cast?
Well, the cast is, you know, sort of lavishly famous. Early on, you see John Travolta and Nick Nolte, and you have Sean Penn, you have John Cusack. It seems like wherever you turn, some familiar face is doing a cameo as a member of C Company or Charlie Company, which is what you're following in the film. Certain people are particularly good. I think Nick Nolte as a kind of overly aggressive military leader. It gives a really wonderful performance. I mean, he's actually had a very good year. He's got another film coming out called Affliction, where I think he gives a really brilliant performance. So he's particularly good. And actually, Sean Penn gives quite a restrained performance. But what's interesting to me in this film is that in transforming Jones's novel, Malick has to find some sort of figure who's his figure. Because in the Jones novel, there's a character played in the film by Adrian Brody, who's the kind of writer's alter ego. That character has been basically written out of the Malick film. But there's another character who's sort of a coal miner, AWOL guy, who's been pumped up in the Malick film, and he's kind of the Zen consciousness of the film. And it's clear that Malick has invented this character who somehow represents his consciousness. And so you, in the same kind of way that in Saving Private Ryan, the coward is sort of the Spielberg figure, in this film, the kind of Zen master, heroic guy is the Malick figure.
Now, we should mention that Thin Red Line is really only opening in New York and Los Angeles for the holiday season for Academy Award qualification, and the rest of us will have to wait to see it in the new year. What's opening nationally on Christmas Day?
Okay, I think the big national opening on Christmas Day is a film called Stepmom, starring Susan Sarandon and Julia Roberts, which is, you know, being much buzzed about in Hollywood. There's lots of talk of Oscars. It's being presented as this huge prestige film. And basically, it's a story about Susan Sarandon is a wife, an ex-wife in her 40s, and Julia Roberts plays the girlfriend of her ex-husband. And the question is, how are they going to negotiate dealing with the kids? And so it's basically about their sort of rivalry, which then turns into a kind of respect and friendship over time.
How is it?
Well, in all honesty, I don't think it's very good. Out here, they're acting as though this is a very classy, serious, dramatic film. But it's very much in the sort of terms of endearment and one true thing vein. It's actually another film where the great dramatic resolution is provided by somebody getting cancer. I mean, it's actually kind of funny because if you go to see the trailers of Stepmom, you would think you're going to see a kind of cheerful romp Because what they don't tell you in the trailer is that about halfway through, the Sarandon character gets cancer. I mean, you know, the joke I keep making is that the title of the film should probably be called You've Got Cancer, because it's, you know, they're trying to keep it cheerful and upbeat, yet really it's not a cheerful and upbeat film.
Well, there's another illness movie opening for the holidays. I think it's opening for the holidays. Patch Adams with Robin Williams as a doctor who's a sensitive man of conscience who heals us with his humor.
Yeah. I keep trying to get myself to be willing to go, but I have skipped this film a lot of times in the screenings. You know, I like Robin Williams, but this is the kind of role I think I don't really want to have him play anymore. Where basically he is the heroic healing figure, and everything he does is funny and heroic and charming. You know, so there are lots of shots, and you can see this even in the trailer, which is one reason why I'm so reluctant to see the film, of basically him cutting up, and then you see a reaction shot, you know, by some old person in their hospital bed or a young bald child with cancer applauding and laughing merrily at Robin's antics. And there is, as you can tell once again from the trailer, the evil doctor who doesn't want to have doctors and patients exist on the same human level. And then, of course, you know, the Robin Williams character triumphs. It's really, I find it kind of discouraging because Williams is an extraordinarily talented person, yet he somehow is getting himself too often into this particular kind of sentimental heroic role that, you know, that I frankly don't want to see.
I'll tell you, I've thought often while watching these coming attractions what it would be like to be stuck in bed in a hospital and have a doctor coming in with, you know, a banana nose and a balloon nose and just like one bad sight gag after another. I think it would just be appalling.
Yes, well, what's funny is that, you know, in person, you know, Robin Williams is a very shy, charming, intelligent person who is sort of effortlessly funny, but not in the way that they're showing in the film, so far as I can tell.
Yeah, the patient's sweating a fever and the doctor has flop sweat because his jokes are so bad.
Yeah.
So that's opening for Christmas?
That's opening wide for Christmas. And, you know, to be fair to the film, since I'm essentially reviewing the trailer, you know, that it has tested very well for the company and a lot of people seem to like it.
Now, what about A Civil Action? I think that one's opening for Christmas too.
Yeah, A Civil Action is only opening in New York and L.A. On Christmas Day. You know, it's a story of a very familiar sort of Oscar-grabbing kind. John Travolta plays a personal injury attorney who more or less is cynical and greedy and preening and all those things. And then he gets involved in the case in a town where a bunch of kids have gotten leukemia and various diseases because of something befouling their water. So he takes on a suit for these families in this small town, and over the course of the film becomes more obsessed and ennobled by his desire to help them. What's interesting to me in the film is that it was directed in the directorial debut by Steven Zaillian, who wrote Schindler's List for Steven Spielberg. And it's essentially the same story, where you start off with the selfish guy who then is sort of redeemed by helping other people.
So you didn't like it very much?
No, it's not a terrible film. It's a very familiar kind of film.
Mm-hmm.
John Travolta his performance is sort of up and down in the film. I think he's often not as his best when he's supposed to be playing overly sharp people. I mean, I felt some of the same things here that I felt in watching Primary Colors, was that he has many, many virtues, but I think one of them is not really being able to sort of convey razor keen intelligence. You know, I mean, I don't know whether he's personally intelligent, but I think somehow he's better at sort of a more emotionally expansive kind of role. And he just doesn't strike me as my image of a legal sharpie. If I think back to the Richard Gere film Primal Fear, you actually could believe that Richard Gere was a smart, cold, calculating attorney. And you don't quite feel that about Travolta. So his performance is sort of up and down. And, you know, one final thing, I just want to mention this, a particular hobby horse of mine, is Hollywood has got to stop doing one particular thing, Terry, which is sticking in useless and annoying cameos into their films. So at the end of A Civil Action, the final scene is more or less in a courtroom. And I'm not giving anything away to say that because it's a court film. In a courtroom. But basically, the last 3 minutes of the film, a new judge appears, and it's Kathy Bates. And she's never been in the film to this point. And what happens is you're at the climax of the film, and everybody's saying, is that Kathy Bates? The same thing had happened in Beloved when, in the climactic scene, when more or less the Oprah Winfrey character is reaching her great moment of truth, and the character of Beloved vanishes, all because of the appearance of a liberal white man, a decent liberal white man. The problem is the decent liberal white man is played by Jason Robards. And this is the climax of the film. And when I saw the screening, virtually everyone in the theater turned to the person next to them and said, "Is that Jason Robards?"
I had that experience in the middle of Saving Private Ryan when all of a sudden I started saying, wait, it's what's-his-name from Cheers.
Yes. No, that's precisely the problem. For some reason, and you even have a bit of that in Thin Red Line as well, because there's so many people in the cast. You know, so suddenly you've gone all through this film, and then at the very end, the new company commander arrives, and it's George Clooney.
My guest is film critic John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air film critic John Powers. We're talking about new movies opening for the holidays. There's a few big animated films for the holidays, Prince of Egypt, A Bug's Life. I think Ants is still in theaters. The Babe sequel. Any of those that you recommend?
Well, actually, easily the best of the bunch is Babe.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, one of the sad things is that at this point, Babe has been declared a flop because it got crunched at the box office by A Bug's Life. And, you know, various heads have rolled at Universal and all sorts of things. But of those four films, the most inventive, magical, best directed and best made film is clearly Babe, which is a slightly darker sequel to the original Babe, which was a very light and charming film. This film is kind of probably more fairy tale like and more Dickensian. It has slightly more haunting images. You know, people, I think, are worried about taking their kids to it, although I think there's nothing half as traumatic in Babe, the sequel, as there is in, say, Bambi. I mean, that was the first film I ever saw. And I mean, even now, you know, I shudder at the thought of Bambi's mother getting killed, whereas there's nothing in Babe that's like that. As for the others, you know, A Bug's Life's sort of very entertaining corporate film. I mean, you can, you know, each new character that's introduced, you can sort of think, oh, well, I can see how they're going to market that one. You know, it's like a very skillful collection of on-screen action figures. And then there's Prince of Egypt, which is some sort of labor of love for DreamWorks and contains two genuinely remarkable sequences in its depiction of the life of, I guess, the young Moses. You know, there are two scenes that are absolutely extraordinary. There's a dream sequence that will knock your eyes out, and there's a scene where all the firstborn of Egypt are being killed that's really kind of haunting and eerie. But as for the rest, it's boring and kind of preachy, and contains some of the worst music I've ever heard. I left the theater talking to friends, and we were all thinking, like, you know, back in the old days, Disney films had great songs. You know, the Disney films, you know, Disney, you know, Disney films had such good songs that people like Miles Davis would play them. You know, now the songs are so rotten that you leave a movie that's filled with songs and you can't think of a single line from the songs or a single melodic bit from the songs. There, you know, it's a Hans Zimmer score and it's as undistinguished a piece of, you know, musical writing as I've ever heard.
So they don't sing the Ten Commandments of love in it, huh?
Well, no. What's curious is that because it's a slightly more upbeat film than that, you know, Moses never really gets to the point where he delivers the Ten Commandments, which I think might kind of bum people out, you know, because it's like they're Moses, the Prince of Egypt, who's liberating his people, is also telling them all sorts of stuff they can't do. You know, so you don't get to that point. You just get to the point where he basically leads his people to freedom, and then the film stops.
Any other holiday movies you want to talk about?
Well, there are a couple films that aren't opening nationwide, but that do deserve mention just because I think they will make their way into lots of, you know, 10 best lists and receive lots of awards. Neither of them are very large films, but I think that they're actually very good and interesting films. The first is called Hillary and Jackie, which is the story about the relationship between two sisters. One of them is Jacqueline Dupré, who's the famous cellist, the English cellist, who got MS and then died of complications from that at a very young age. She was kind of a great cult figure in England. And the story is about her relationship with her sister, Hillary, who, in fact, when they were young, was the more talented one of the two, and then gradually watched her sister sort of skyrocket into genius while she didn't get any better. But, in contrast, she married happily and had a sort of happy home life, whereas her genius sister was miserable, unhappy, and basically her, you know, she was sort of, she sort of felt crucified on her cello. And it's about the weird interaction between the incredibly warm and attentive sister who's not a genius and the very demanding and crazy-making sister who is the genius. It's beautifully acted by two actresses that people will have seen before. Jackie Dupre, the crazier one, is played by Emily Watson, who is in Breaking the Waves, and she gives another great performance here. Hillary is played by Rachel Griffiths, who a lot of you will remember if you saw Muriel's Wedding. She was the person who played Muriel's zany friend. She's a really wonderful actress, and she in a way has the more difficult role because she's the person who has to bottle everything up and sort of show all her feelings through a kind of veneer of decency and niceness. It's a very good film, and one of the handful of films this year, I think, that really lets actresses shine. The other film that I think that I like is the Paul Schrader adaptation of Russell Banks' novel Affliction. What I particularly like in it, and I will probably talk about this film on a later show, but what I particularly like about this film is the performance by Nick Nolte as this kind of lost cop who—he's this kind of a big man who's melting down. You know, his marriage is collapsing. He realizes that he's sort of a flunky for the big boss in town. He's got a terrible toothache, which is sort of the metaphor for his whole life. And it's, I think, a genuinely brilliant performance by Nolte, who's one of the best screen actors we have. This may be the best performance he ever gave. I think it's the best performance by a male that I saw this year.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue. He'll be back with his 10 best list on Thursday. At the start of this TV season, our critic David Bianculli surveyed the field of new series and found no absolute standout. He did, however, identify 5 new series as promising. Now that we're nearing mid-season, David checks in to see whether any of those shows are fulfilling their early promise.
Based on the pilot episodes of this year's new fall series, I gave 5 shows good enough marks to recommend them. Leading the pack was Felicity, the WB Network's drama series starring Kerry Russell as a college freshman. Then there were 2 somewhat silly hour-long comedy dramas, Buddy Farrow and Fantasy Island, and, finally, 2 new sitcoms, That 70s Show and Sports Night. Well, here's what's happened since then. Felicity, like many college freshmen, has gotten mopey, self-absorbed, and visibly tired. It's in a rut, and it better start climbing out soon. Buddy Farrow on CBS, with Dennis Farina as a throwback detective from the Rat Pack era reopening his business in the 90s, started strong but never slipped into a second gear. ABC's remake of Fantasy Island with Malcolm McDowell, I kept watching and enjoying, but I think I was the only one. Even though there are a few more episodes to run, ABC has already canceled it. That leaves the 2 sitcoms. The Fox period comedy That 70s Show has remained fresh and clever and developed into a show where every single character is likable, identifiable, and very, very funny. And finally, there's ABC's Sports Night, which has turned into the best new show from the first half of the season. And if you didn't jump aboard the Sports Night train at the start of the season, you get another chance Tuesday night as ABC repeats the original premiere. The action takes place at the Continental Sports Channel, a thinly veiled version of ESPN. Peter Krause and Josh Charles star as Casey and Dan, the star anchors of the network's Sports Night wrap-up show. Behind them, and behind the scenes, are Felicity Huffman, Joshua Molina, and Sabrina Lloyd as producers and assistants, and Robert Guillaume, formerly of Benson, as the boss. The series comes from Aaron Sorkin, who wrote A Few Good Men, and he's brought a feature film sensibility to Sports Night. For one thing, it's as much a drama as it is a comedy. For another, the characters are deep and surprising and often very flawed. For a third, the behind-the-scenes TV talk and TV battles are right on the money. Here's a scene from a rundown meeting in which a network representative objects to a lengthy feature in that night's story lineup.
I have some concerns about segment 23. Is this you or the network? In these meetings, Casey, mine is the voice of the network.
Wow, JJ.
What are your concerns?
Who is Antozaki Nelson, and why are you doing a 3-minute and 20-second feature on him?
Natalie!
Antozaki Nelson's a South African distance runner, 15,000 meters. As a schoolteacher in Jamestown, he led protests against the white majority.
That's swell, but folks, I have...
No, he was beaten up and thrown in jail. His legs were broken, and the doctor said he'd never walk without a cane. He's 41 years old, and guess what he's doing tonight?
It doesn't matter, because I've already changed the channel.
He's running in the World Pacific Games, an event this network is carrying live tonight at 9. The Entezaki Nelson features promoting...
Look, I am all for you guys spotlighting our other programming, but can't we find a good-looking 22-year-old American who might actually win?
Well, if you find him, send him over to my place, but in the meantime...
Look, I have a ratings book on my desk that's very instructive. Now, it says that our key demographics, including 11 to 17-year-olds who watch your morning rerun over breakfast, do not want to see features about 41-year-old, politically oppressed, third-world distance runners. Now, they are instructing us, and I think it's a good idea to listen.
I've got Jason Grissom on the phone. JJ, Danny and I have hosted shows in the fifth and third largest markets in the country, and we've received awards for journalistic excellence. I'd prefer not to take my instructions from 11-year-olds. And the next time you sit in our rundown meeting and I hear the voice of the network come out of your mouth, I'm going to put my foot on your throat.
Since the season began, these characters have bonded, fought, blossomed, and grown. And there have been serious issues tackled, too. Sexual assaults by athletes, drug use by TV personalities, and the whole tricky dance between professional sports organizations and a network trying to cover them. Sports Night is sharply written, very nicely acted, and almost always contains a genuine surprise or two. In my book, that's a promise delivered. If you haven't started watching it yet, now's the time.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.